All right, and it is 11 o'clock and time for another Spotlight here on Red River Radio. Good morning to you. I'm Kermit Poling. Joining me in the studio, Michael Butterman, music director of the Shreveport Symphony, along with the stage director for this very special presentation that's coming up on Sunday. That is Robert New. Welcome to Red River Radio Studios.
Thanks so much.
And essentially Sunday, you know, for lack of a better way to describe it, history is going to be made here.
I think so. Yeah. In fact, I as far as I know, we at Shreveport has not seen a full production of the St. Matthew Passion.
Not in my 35 years, for sure. It may have been done maybe in the 60s and
perhaps,
all of that.
But it's
not only the incredible piece, too, but a unique way of presenting it. And I know for sure that that's not been done.
Correct. So even if there had been, let's say, more than 35 years ago, a performance of the St. Matthew Passion in its entirety, it certainly was not presented in this way, which is to say in a semi-staged theatrical realization, I guess, yeah. you might say. Just to even say that we have a stage director for the St. Matthew Passion already says something a little bit unusual
right
about
off the top,
how we are
go.
Approaching this. I should probably just begin by giving a little bit of background. This is a work that Bach wrote for a Good Friday performance at Thomaskirche in Leipzig, which is a telling of the Passion story using the Gospel of Matthew and also some arias that were free verse that were responding emotionally to the text of the Gospel, and it's a work for two choruses, two orchestras, actually also a children's chorus. We are having Centenary College Choir, Prisma Vocal Ensemble, and the Boys and Girls Chorus from St. Mark's Cathedral joining us. And it's a work for two solo singers who kind of tell the story, the evangelist, who is the narrator, and Jesus, who sings the words of Jesus, as well as four aria soloists, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass. And so we have brought those six persons to town. They are absolutely world-class artists, and also a few other unusual sorts of instruments, at least unusual for our day here, a viola da gamba, very, very beautiful cello-like instrument, I guess I would describe it, and a couple of sort of lower-pitched oboes called oboes d'amore, as well as what were called oboes da caccia, but now are essentially just played by English horns. So some unusual kinds of sounds, as well as a tiny little organ, which is playing the continuo part. It's a portative organ, a little sort of self-contained unit. Looks a bit like the size of a small refrigerator, I suppose.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Yeah, which is being provided by First Methodist Church. So all of this comes together to create an unbelievably expressive and beautiful musical experience. But the addition of making clear somehow the dramatic context of this takes it to an entirely different level. Bob and I collaborated on this a couple of years ago in Colorado, and it was truly life-changing for me, anyway, and something that once we had done there, I really, really wanted to do again as soon as possible, and I'm so grateful that we were able to present it here on Sunday.
Yeah. Well, Bob, why don't you talk a little bit about, since, I mean, this is, it's an oratorio, but here we're seeing it presented more closer to an opera. Talk a little bit about the approach to make that work.
Well, I'm convinced that if Bach had not made his career as a church musician, that he would have composed operas. I mean, everybody then was composing their opera. And this piece is an opera. I mean, the way it's structured, the dramatic way the text is delivered, and the dramatic way the story is delivered is just very operatic. So when I was first asked to do this, I have to admit I was intimidated, just because I think it's one of the greatest works that exists. Plus, the story is, of course, a story that everyone knows.
Sure.
But then I found out that going all the way back to George Balanchine, who was the famous founder of New York City Ballet in the 30s, he'd staged a production back in New York in the 30s and the 40s. It's been done several times since then, quite a few times. Peter Sellers, the American director, did a very famous production with the Berlin Philharmonic about 10 years ago. And again, the more I researched it and thought about it in operatic terms, it seemed pretty obvious that it would work in that way as long as one had some restraint in not making it overly obvious. The music tells so much that you have to kind of not get in the way of the music. So our production is, it's not a literal, you won't see literal representations on stage. You see something that just is more suggestive, symbolic, a lot of use of ritual.
Yeah, and to be clear, okay, so this is being done in the Sanctuary of First Baptist mm-hmm. Church, which is where most of the performances of the Shreveport Symphony have been this year. So this isn't something that really has, you know, we think opera and you think of set pieces and all of that other stuff. It's very minimalist, although you have places where, stations, or you want to call them that.
That's a great way to say it, yeah. I mean, we use the entire space, the entire sanctuary, of course, but there are no sets. There are four wooden boxes, that's mm-hmm. all, that are used in various configurations. Jesus is not, put on a cross in this. He is in a symbolic way. You'll have to come to find out exactly what I mean by that. and everybody is dressed in contemporary clothes. So there's no attempt to recreate the period or, again, to do a literal retelling of the story.
Yeah, and of course the message would be within the story and within the music anyway, and that's what Bach would have intended. And of course, the Lutheran background and going back to Martin Luther and making getting away from the Latin and getting into a vernacular that everybody could understand. Mm-hmm. And in this case, even though it's being sung in the German that Bach wrote, you're going to have surtitles for translation and the staging to, again, help the audience understand each
Precisely.
Moment.
Well, that's it. And I think if you listen to it in the concert hall, which is certainly a wonderful and valid experience, unless you're following along in the program, I think there's a lot of nuance you miss in the glorious way that Bach set this text. Whereas I think in our production, you maybe have a little bit more of an enriched experience that you can see it and you understand from the actors and singers. But also the surtitles, I'm just so thrilled that worked here because any opera anymore offers us surtitles, so we really can follow the story.
That's true. So this work, and really Bach wrote other passions as well, the St. John's Passions, the only other one that survives.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is really sad because you got to think about, well, what did he do with the other Gospels?
Right.
But arguably, the St. Matthew Passion is the stronger and more compelling of the two to a lot of people. At least it is to me. And liturgically, it's based on Matthew 26 and 27. Mm-hmm. But that's the framework. And interspersed in all of the numbers is the enhancement of the story.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's, as I was mentioning, there was a librettist that Bach worked with. Picander was his pen name, and he is the one who wrote these arias, which are responsive to the texts at the various moments in the gospel. And there, of course, speaking of Luther's desire to bring the story to the people in a very direct way, there are, I'm not even sure how many, maybe a dozen and a half chorales mm-hmm. in throughout, which are hymn tunes that the congregation at the time would have been very familiar with, and which are harmonized, sometimes uses the very same melody, but harmonizes it four or five different times in four or five different ways to respond to the different emotional contexts that are happening throughout the piece. And I would just say one more thing about what Bach, what Bob, I did this to you yesterday. I have great reference for you.
I don't mind.
What Bob said a moment ago about the dramatic context and the ability to kind of perceive what is happening. I think that certainly with the staging that we have, there will be it will be easier to understand sort of moment to moment exactly what is happening in the story. You will be able to see the text on the walls behind the performers and know see exactly how Bach has set certain words in a very sort of poignant way. But beyond that, I think people do know this, the outlines of the plot well enough, I'm sure. What Bob's staging does, I think, is helps to contextualize the emotional content of some of these arias, where that you've set up relationships, I think, between these mm-hmm. these aria soloists and sometimes and the evangelist and Jesus, or sometimes between each other, or sometimes between them and the chorus, who right. take on different roles as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I found fascinating as I worked on it, that clearly I think these four unnamed soloists are meant to be different characters. I mean, sometimes it's very explicit in the text. But the very first aria, for instance, that the soprano sings, is she's singing as the mother of Judas, knowing what Judas is about to do, and dealing with the guilt of having raised a child that can do this. In the very next aria, she becomes, in my opinion, Mary Magdalene, who has this very personal relationship with Jesus the man. So there's a lot of opportunity with what we're doing, I think, to not only humanize all these arias, but also to humanize Jesus, which is what ultimately makes it, I think, a compelling story. So it's not just a symbol, but also an individual.
Sure. Michael, talk a little bit, because you sort of hinted at this, that the different harmonizations to some of the chorales and also the orchestrations and the differentiation that really ties to the text throughout the piece. Coming to mind are the flutes, the dropping of
there's blood, a lot of tear dropping.
Yeah. Yes, tear dropping and that piece. Type of thing. Yeah,
and sometimes it's with these little very poignant sort of leaning gestures, but a lot of times it's literally the sort of thing. There's sort of a dialogue between two flutes, and it's really just quite effective. So there's lots and lots of examples of text painting throughout the piece. There are the fact that he has two orchestras and two choruses allows for a sense of dialoguing, and this is a very kind of Lutheran approach. Luther's catechisms are in fact written very much almost in a Socratic fashion, if anybody's familiar with them, where there's a sort of a question asked and then a response, a question and a response. Mm-hmm. And as Luther myself, I know in the liturgy there's lots of the sort of back and forth ritualization that goes on between, let's say, a pastor and the congregation. And so we have a lot of this in the very, very opening chorus. We have a dialogue set up between chorus one and chorus two. Chorus one is saying, you know, come daughters, help me mourn. And the chorus two is basically saying, what? Where? Why? What? What's going on? Just please tell me. And there's lots of other examples of a conversation that goes on between these two choruses, and sometimes between the soloist and the chorus as well.
Mm-hmm. And between the orchestra and the soloist and the orchestra and chorus as well.
Yeah, absolutely right. These are not large orchestras, I should point out. There are strings and two flutes and two oboes in both orchestra, plus an organ. But there's no brass. Right. There's no percussion. And yet, with what seems like limited resources, he has created this incredible sound world that is just seemingly limitless in its variety and its possibilities. And part of that does have to do with his harmonizations. Bach his harmonic language is positively, you know, Wagnerian sometimes. It's just so rich and chromatic. And if you contrast it with another great composer, Vivaldi, but who had a very different approach to sort of the way that harmony functions, where he would sort of set up a harmony that kind of sits there for five or six bars at a time and then goes on to something else. Bach doesn't have the same harmony sometimes from one eighth note to the next eighth note.
Oh, yeah. It's just amazing. And his melodic treatment also. One day in rehearsal a few days ago, Michael and I were both getting a little tired at the end of the day, and we both at one point said, but you know, you start one of these arias and you just become energized because it's so brilliant. The music is so wonderful. I mean, you can experience it as a musician where you intellectually appreciate it as well as emotionally, but then just as a layperson, you're kind of going, why? This is so amazing. It's beyond articulation, which is all great music, is that.
So we ought to just remind everybody the time of the performance, 3:00, and it's on Sunday. So a Palm Sunday performance, which again, considering the nature of the work, is the perfect time. It's not Good Friday, but it certainly is, you know, leading Holy Week leading up to it, and a time to contemplate if you are a Christian, the story. So that goes in hand with it. 3:00, Palm Sunday, First Baptist Church. Tickets and information are at ShreveportSymphony.com, and you can also call 318-227-TUNE, that is 8863, for what is likely you know, for at least for maybe a generation. Who knows? It would be the one opportunity that you have to hear the St. Matthew Passion of Bach. It's for a number of reasons. It's obviously a great work, but it's also a longer work, and it takes the forces that you were talking about, which makes it not an easy thing to plan and put together. It takes a real commitment to do it.
It is extraordinarily difficult to put together because of the number of different components and the logistics and so on, which I don't need to get into. But just I will say that is one of the reasons that it is done infrequently. It's just difficult to assemble this kind of a cast and crew and devote the kind of time that is necessary. But you know, this is the sort of piece. I don't mean to overstate it, but this is why you are a musician. This is why you.
This is why you're a human being.
There you go.
There you go. That is it. And you also hinted at some of the. Where the story is within the orchestra and all of that, I will say as someone who got to play at the Concertmaster has what Yehudi Menuhin called the most beautiful violin solo in the world.
Yes.
Period. That was coming from a concert violinist who played every great concerto, but for him, that's like the magical
time
moment.
Just stops during that aria.
It does.
It
absolutely does. So there are, for those of you who also like to, you know, and it's an accompanimental solo, but still are just as interested as what's going on in the orchestra as what you're hearing from the choruses and from the soloists and all of that. I mean, those moments are there as well.
And I want to mention, like any great universal piece, this is not, it doesn't matter what your belief system is or if you have a belief system. It's bigger than that, you know, so anybody can find their way into this piece. You don't have to have a Christian upbringing to relate to this piece. It's about life and it's about redemption.
Sure.
Yeah, right, absolutely. It's got sort of those qualities of that a lot of opera has, betrayal and a certain amount of, obviously, a great deal of suffering and so on, but there's also forgiveness, you know, and selfless love and almost a sense of thanksgiving. And I completely agree. It is a piece that no matter what your spiritual orientation, or if you have a spiritual orientation, I guess, that you're never the same after experiencing this piece. It's just... you just aren't.
Absolutely.
You can't be.
Absolutely true. And it's, it's an overwhelming experience. It's a longer experience as well. So when you come, don't expect this to be over in an hour and a half or 2 hours.
It's a journey.
It's a journey. And it's a journey that is well worth taking. So plan your afternoon to come and spend an afternoon there for something that is just you called it in somewhere, or maybe it's on the website, monumental, that's kind of an understatement, really.
It is, yes. But it feels like you have, you've just been through something. I was saying yesterday that there are lots of moments that are lovely and uplifting and kind of almost toe tapping, I guess that's not quite there, but ultimately this is a work of gravitas, and it is a work that it's not entertaining necessarily. I think it is that is not its place. It is something on a different plane. So if people are approaching it, understanding that it's going to kind of suspend time for a while. Yeah. I think
that's a great way to put it. And I might add, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about the casting, because you have some phenomenal singers in the solo roles.
We do. And so we have an evangelist and Jesus that Bob and I worked with in Colorado. I have to say the evangelist role is sung entirely in recitative, which means that there are not so many sort of song-like melodic patterns, but it's more just sort of getting the text across, and it is a to memorize this as he has done is just a feat that I stand in awe of.
It's incomprehensible to me that somebody could do it.
Yeah, and he does it so unbelievably. Well, and we have so that's Stephen Morshuk, our bass, who teaches at UNT, and Derek Chester, our evangelist, who teaches in Colorado, and then we have Tess Altiveros, our soprano, Abigail Nims, our mezzo, and Brian Wallen, tenor, and Andy Wachowski, our bass, just assembled from really all over the U.S. And I just think we couldn't have a better group, frankly.
It really is. It's a great cast. They're so evenly matched as far as the way they approach the piece, I think, temperamentally. And just, I mean, this is a hard sing for everybody. It's very exposed. You just have to have a lot of control. And again, it's not, for any of these roles, it's not typical to memorize this. Usually you're staying in front of the orchestra with
oratorio
music.
Oratorio style with the music.
Yeah, so it was a big, it is a big commitment from all these artists who have agreed to go that extra, you know, journey to memorize it for us.
It's going to be an amazing experience. This Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock, in the sanctuary of First Baptist Church, along with the soloists, of course, I think, Michael, you mentioned the Centenary College Choir is participating, Prisma, and there's also
the Boys and Girls Choir from St. Mark's.
Yeah, and which also really fits, and of course, in Bach's own world, they would have all been, all of the trebles would have been
the boys from his church school, essentially. The choir school there.
So I mean, times have changed a little bit, but that's just a great enhancement of it. And you're going to do a pre-concert talk?
Yes, thanks. The performance begins at 3, and there's a pre-concert talk at 2:10 in Frost Chapel, which is obviously in the same building, just sort of adjacent. So that'll be a chance to, there is, you know, we have about a half an hour to do that, and there's just not enough time.
We've got lots to cover.
However, it's still enough time to kind of provide you will be able to walk in at 3 o'clock and have an unbelievably overwhelming, I think, emotional experience with this piece. However, if you can spare a little bit of time ahead of that, you'll have a little bit more of an insight into some of the background. And we'll go into just a little bit about the way that Bach sets up some of these scenes, and we'll talk a little bit about even a lot of the numerological symbolism that Bach includes in this piece, which is abundant and always revealing more mysteries to me as I read more about it and study it myself. It's just, it's clear that he was writing this. This was not just another piece he was cracking out for, you know, the next church service. This was something he was doing. He really was doing this for posterity. He clearly lavished special attention. His manuscript had, he sort of re-inked. He'd used red for all the words of Jesus and so on. He really wanted this. He understood that he was doing something.
Well, my guest, Robert New, who's the stage director for this presentation, this experience, Michael Butterman, music director of the Shreveport Symphony, in the studio. We're talking about the St. Matthew Passion, the music of Bach, a very rare opportunity to experience this live in performance, and with enhancements, as we've been talking about, to make it an even more memorable event. That is Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock, and you can get tickets and find out more, including some program notes, at the Shreveport Symphony site. That's shreveportsymphony.com. If you'd like to call, you can call 318-227-TUNE. That is 8863. So, Bob, Michael, thanks for being here and talking about that, and break a leg, as they say. I'm looking forward to coming and hearing it. And I think a lot of people, if you've not put it on your calendar yet, this is the thing to do this Sunday. So, guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Kermit.
And if you're with an organization and you have an event coming up you'd like to be featured on a future Spotlight, give us a call at 800-552-8502.